tell me what you just said.
Oh, well, I've always felt, when I was saying earlier, Dick Janeway got me interested in pre-med courses, I did well, and so I said, well, I'll apply to medical school. If I get accepted, I'll go. Then I got into medical school, I did fine. I did particularly well in pediatrics, so I ended up going to pediatrics. It's probably silly to talk that way, but I often saw these as sort of, this is a sign on a guidepost. You're headed in a direction, you meet with some success, you get some positive feedback, and that encourages you to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I don't remember the feeling, and I don't think Celia could tell you that either, because she and I were dating all through high school and college. I mean, we talked on the phone all the time and wrote letters. I don't think I ever had the sense that my life would come to an end if I didn't get into medical school. I didn't think, you know, I never remember thinking, God, I'll have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
I could do other things.
Yeah. Well, because you didn't have made your mind up, as so many of these kids I heard who came into medical school who said, oh, God, I decided this when I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
And nor
my sons. Peter and, I don't want to speak for them, but Peter and Chris,
yeah.
Wandered around into high school and college, and finally they applied and they did well. But, I mean, there wasn't this anxiety in my house that if you don't become a doctor, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown and you'll be a failure. And I never, as a kid or as a youngster or a college kid, ever felt that way.
You had a second plan of attack anyway.
Or at least I had a sense that I'll survive doing something.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a sense that if I don't do this, I'm dead. I can't go on with life. I said, well, you know, I can do something else, you know.
I think probably you must have been a pretty happy-go-lucky kid when you think, even with the loss that you suffered so
happy
young.
I'm not sure I'd say happy-go-lucky, but I think I always, probably from my mother and my older brother and sisters and all these other people who have helped me along the line, I always had a good self-esteem, a sense
mm-hmm.
of myself. I never mm-hmm. felt...
Well,
I never felt like a failure when I got an F in German. That was just a mistake.
Yeah.
Screwed up. But I didn't feel like a failure. And I had and that would be the only exception I can think of, everything I tried or took on, I usually succeeded at, with varying degree of work or varying degree of help. And I do not believe, frankly, and I don't feel this about anybody I've ever known, that they did it on their own. I mean, I just don't think that's true. Everybody got help from somebody, either they knew about it or they didn't. You know, someone had to start the school system, someone had to get people going. No, in my view, no one has ever done anything totally on their own. I think it's silly for people to say that. Sure, they worked their ass off, they struggled, they took advantage of all the opportunities, but as far as I know, everybody that I've ever known that was successful got a lot of help from somebody.
Now, where did Dick Janeway go?
Oh, he went to Penn.
Oh.
He went to Penn and married the daughter of one of his professors at the University of Pennsylvania, then went from there like I did. He joined the Air Force because he needed money. He was broke too. His father, I think, was an automobile salesman he actually sold fire engines. And he was a relatively poor kid. He came to Colgate on the exact same scholarship I came on. And that's how we met the first day we arrived. They put 25 of us in the same room and say, you're the cream of the crop. We brought you here on scholarships and we expect great things from you. They told us they expected stuff from us.
Where did he come from?
He came from Merchantville, New Jersey, which is right across the river from Philadelphia, out just past Camden. And a modest family. He came there on a scholarship. And so we had a camaraderie there. Neither of us had two nickels to knock together. I forgot now, he might have made money too, doing other things. Because they give us scholarships for tuition and room and books and that stuff, but the room and board you had to work for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of anybody who got free room and board. You had to do something. Cut grass or some damn thing.
Yeah.
So he and I had a very similar background in that regard. although his parents were alive. Anyway, he went to Penn, and then he went to went to the Air Force. We met several times. He was stationed in England while we were stationed in Madrid. We went to a meeting together in Wiesbaden, Germany, and then we'd gone to each other's weddings. Then he went and when he got out of the Air Force, he went back and got his training in neurology. Became a neurologist at Bowman Gray and turned out to be appointed the dean there. Spent in Winston-Salem, spent 30-some years there.
Great friendship.
As the dean, yeah.
Great friendship.
Yeah.
Where did Cecilia go to college?
Cecilia left Ursuline the same year I left Iona and went to Trinity College. First of all, she went to St. Elizabeth's College in Morristown, New Jersey for 2 years with several of her classmates, didn't like it, and transferred down to Trinity College in Washington, D.C., spent her third and fourth year there, and graduated from Trinity. And then came back home and worked at the Rockefeller Institute for 2 years until we could get married. Then when we got married at the end of we were 2 years out of college, I was finishing my second year of medical school, we got married and she moved to Albany and she worked as the secretary for the dean of the nursing school for a year and a half or so, or until our first son came along.
So you didn't see much of each other during those years?
Not a lot. Summers, Christmas, Easter, every vacation.
And letter writing.
And we wrote letters and talked on the phone.
People don't do that anymore. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
They don't write letters. Oh,
Celia's a letter writer. She's got tons of letters.
Really?
Yeah. And when we were in Spain, she wrote letters to her mother. Her mother kept every one of them. We got them down in the basement. So Celia's a writer.
Yes.
Writing is a way she expresses herself. She's written several books and hundreds of articles. So writing has always been important to her.
But you don't hear
boyfriends and girlfriends
writing letters back and forth.
Yeah.
It's the telephone or it's faxes.
Well, that's true. No, we wrote, of course, you can, I guess, mail them for a nickel or a dime or 70 cents. And so there were big gaps so it was meant to be, I guess. So
did she, when you were married, and she was already through college.
She had been working in New York for 2 years.
Yeah. And you were.
She worked at the Rockefeller Institute for she had a fascinating job. She worked for D.W. Woolley, who was a biochemist at the Rockefeller, who was blind. He went blind because of his diabetes, and Celia's job was to read journals to him and to help him with all of his correspondence.
Wow.
But he did his lab work with his technicians and helpers by himself. He knew he was going blind, and for a number of years, in preparation for his total blindness, had set up his lab in such a way that he could work in his lab, but he couldn't read the journals. And most journals were in Braille, and they didn't have talking machines like they have now. So much of her job, she did secretary work, but she would file his journal, and he'd say, yeah, I want the journal that's up on the fourth shelf, that's five over, and it's dated, December, such and such, and she'd pull it down, and he'd remember but just read that it said again, and he was one of the earliest experimenters, not personally, but with animals, with LSD and other drugs, and demonstrated their effect upon animals.
But I think what we'll do is stop now.
Yeah, sure.
Put this on hold.
Yeah, sure.
And when we come back, I'd like to talk about, we'll start with your first year in medical school. I want to hear your feelings about that and whether or not you thought you had made a big mistake. All right, today is Thursday, March
12th.
And we're continuing with this tape, talking to Dr. Scully. Dr. Scully, when we left off last time, we decided to talk about medical school. You told us how you decided to go there, and it was through your roommate. Now, Dick Janway was your roommate in college.
Yes, right. Roommate and a fraternity brother. Actually, I guess.
In Sigma Nu.
Right. So we lived in the same fraternity house for 4 years, essentially.
You said that you had a story that you wanted to tell me about that, and I don't know if we did cover that already.
Yes, we did.
Something about Dick Janway and getting you into medical school?
No, mostly encouraging me to take some pre-med courses, and then he helped me through school. I mean, a lot of times he would help me with my studies. No, he didn't help me get into medical school, per se. He encouraged me to do that. Mm-hmm. But Charlie Foster, Dr. Foster, who was the head of the biology department and was the pre-med advisor, he was the one who sort of served as the gatekeeper for pre-meds at Colgate. And I've forgotten the exact figures. I think I said last time something like 60 freshmen would start out, and maybe half of them would get through the 4-year pre-med program, which was very stringent. It had a reputation at Colgate as being one of the toughest academic programs. But if you got through those 4 years, then he would personally go to bat for you. And I remember he would travel around the country in the every fall and early winter, and essentially place all of his students. He called them his boys or my boys, mm-hmm. And I think everyone in my senior class got into medical school, but and I think there was some individual judgment by Dr. Foster at that time as to where a particular student might fit in best, and in terms of research and that sort of thing. And so it was Dr. Foster who really took me and others under his wing, and I give him the credit for that.
You're saying that he called them my boys tells me the answer pretty much to my next question, which was, how many women did you have in your class?
Oh, no, Colgate was all men then. Colgate did not become coeducational till about 1975.
Oh, we're talking about Colgate. Sorry, I'm confused.
We're talking about Colgate College,
yes.
Undergraduate.
Well, let me ask you about medical school and just rephrase that question. How many women were there? Very few.
I started medical school in, I can look it up specifically, I started medical school in the fall of 1954, and there were two women in the sophomore class ahead of us. I can remember specifically because one of my classmates married one of them, and there was only one woman in our medical school class out of an entering class of, I'm guessing, 50-ish. I'd have to look that up. And that woman also, she ended up going into pediatrics and married a classmate who was a urologist. So I recall only one woman in my class and two in the class ahead of me. So in the mid-50s, medical school, I think nationwide, I could get the statistics, was probably, I don't know, 90-some% men.
Mm-hmm.
And in my school, but interestingly, there were several women residents training at the Albany Medical Center when I was there in medical school. Two specifically who had a big influence on me, Mary Voorhees was a resident there, and got me interested in pediatrics, encouraged me in pediatrics. She ultimately went on and became a professor of pediatrics at Syracuse University, but I credit her and a few others for fostering my interest in pediatrics. But we're getting a little ahead of the story.
But
there were some women around, but very, very few.
This was, as you said, fairly nationwide.
I think it was, except for the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania, which is now called the Medical College of Pennsylvania. In those days, it was called Women's Medical College, and of course, that was all women. Now they take a few men, and I guess statistically, here it is 40 years later, and roughly half of 40-50% of most medical school classes around the country are now women.
When did you see that starting to change, that toward that trend?
I think
you were keeping up on it pretty much all
through
your career, weren't you?
Yes, I was, and yeah. Well, remember when we started our medical school here at the University of Nevada in 1971, the first entering class had only one woman, mm-hmm. only one woman, Mary Sarawine. And of course it began to evolve over time, and I would guess probably by the early 80s, maybe 20% were women, and I think the most recent classes have been in the 40 to 50% range.
Yeah, I saw that change too, because yeah. when I started up there, those trends were
right.
developing.
80,
each
yeah.
year,
right.
there were more and more mm-hmm. women.
Yeah, it's happening. And it was also the same time that college education, as well as university education, was becoming much more co-educational. Traditional all-men's schools were entering women, and traditional all-women school were admitting men.
But women were more reluctant, it seemed. They were going to college
of course.
Before this trend in medicine started to change.
Oh, yes.
Of accepting women, but I think the women were more reluctant a few years back to get into what was always considered a male society.
Mm-hmm. Although, if you look really back at the turn of the century, before the Flexner era of the 1915 and the change to a university kind of academic environment, women made up a significant percentage of the physicians in this country at the turn of the century. I can look it up, but it was in the range of about 15-20%, but then, of course, that fell off. But prior to the Flexner era in the early 1900s, there were, 300 medical schools, and many of them were proprietary schools that were sort of preceptorships, and it was only after the Flexner report that several hundred of these small medical schools were closed, and it boiled down to something like 65 university-based medical schools beginning in the early 1920s. So there was a period of time when there were lots of women in medicine, but certainly not since the First World War.
Those women, though, stayed in what was considered, primarily they stayed in what was considered women areas.
Yeah. Well, even
because now
right.
you have women mm-hmm. going into urology,
orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery.
Those areas
absolutely.
That were really men-dominated.
Yeah. Oh, that's only been in the last 15 years. You're
yeah.
right.
So you've seen some interesting trends.
Oh, sure. And even when I entered pediatrics, I think it had the highest percentage of women. There were several women in pediatric training with me. So of those women who went to medical school in the late 40s, early 50s, even in the early 60s, many of them went into pediatrics. Then there was, and peculiarly not many went into OB, but many went into pediatrics and internal medicine. But all of that shifted and changed. Now I don't know the exact figures, but there are many more women across the board in, so.
Well now, you graduated? Traditionally, probably June or
in
whenever.
From college.
From college.
That's right.
And what did you do that summer?
Work,
no doubt.
Yes, I worked every summer. I think those. I'd have to look at that biographical sheet I gave you, but I think the last couple of summers. Well, the summer after my second year, I went to Alaska. The summer after my junior and senior year, I worked at the Badger Day Camp. Yes, it was a day camp in a suburban Larchmont right next to New Rochelle. As a matter of fact, Jack Collins, who ran that camp, used to hire girls from Ursuline and boys from Iona and when they went on to college. And most of his camp counselors were college kids. Most of whom were from the New Rochelle, Larchmont area. And I think actually, before we started medical school that summer, Celia and I spent a lot of time together because we were camp counselors and would see each other every day, you know. At that time, the camp was broken up again into boys and girls using the same facilities, but so I don't know, I had a, you know, a, they'd have, two or three counselors for a group of 15 or 20 kids.
What kind of a camp was that?
It was a day camp, you know, with the...
Religious?
No, it wasn't. It was a...
Oriented?
No, private. Mostly fairly well-to-do parents who were sending their kids to day camp to get them out, you know, something to do. They were all well-to-do kids because it cost a lot of money to send the kids there. And we were paid pretty well. But I've forgotten exactly. There might have been 20 male counselors and 20 female counselors for several hundred kids.
Sports, all types of
activities. All kinds of sports. Yeah, and they'd swim and they'd, you know, archery and miniature golf. And I think maybe some would be taken once in a while if they wanted to horseback ride. It was just a day camp.
So you were paid a salary?
I paid a salary. Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I lived at home. But, and, you know, I'd get up in the morning and meet the bus, and the bus would go around the town and pick up these kids who were just like a school bus would do, take them to this day camp. So I did that, and I think that was the last time I ever did that, because once I started medical school, then I had usually jobs around the medical school.
Let's talk a little bit, before we get into the medical school, talk a little bit about the Alaska.
Yeah, well, that was
noticed that was several months.
Yes.
Into the first into your semester work.
Yeah, it was the end of my second year of college. I was at mm-hmm. Colgate, and as I think I said on a previous tape, my roommate and I, or another roommate or classmate, I should say, fraternity brother, and I left school. And as I told you earlier, I walked out essentially of the German exam knowing full well I was going to get an F in German and just took off. And we headed to Alaska in his car, and we drove New York to Anchorage, 5,400 miles in 9 days. I'd drive for 4 hours and he'd sleep and vice versa. And we'd stop every second day and find a hotel and get a shower and get a meal and maybe sleep for a few hours. But what we essentially did was we were only two of probably several hundred college kids, most of whom came from the West Coast. It was the first time I had talked to anybody who'd been to, you know, gone to school in California or Washington, Oregon, Montana, Idaho. And a lot of them would come up to Alaska every summer and work on the highways. At that time, Alaska was not a state, it was a territory. Department of the Interior ran it. And so what we did is, since you could work almost 24 hours a day, their road crews would essentially work around the clock. They'd be laying gravel and paving and that. And so we would be a shift, maybe a 8 to 10 hour shift, driving trucks from the, you know, the cement plant or the rock plant out to where, and we'd dump them and back and forth and back and forth. That's all we did. And I remember that we worked around the clock because we would frequently, if we were on the night shift, or what we'd call the swing shift, I guess, we'd come back and have dinner and play softball at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. The sun was up, you know. The sun, I think, at the peak of the summer, mm-hmm. in July, it was probably 4 hours of darkness.
Yeah.
So we'd be playing softball 10, 11 o'clock at night, or 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning, depending upon what your work schedule was. I've got pictures of myself. I must have put on 30 pounds, because all we did was eat and sleep. And they'd feed you about four meals a day, a full course meal. I mean, breakfast, lunch, and dinner had I don't know how many courses. They just fed all these college kids. We lived in old army barracks on an old army base that was left over from the Second World War, and that's what we did. And
was this a federal?
Yeah, it was a federal
thing?
Yes, yeah.
So
it was,
you were paid by the government. The federal government,
Department,
rather than
sure.
the state of...
No, there was no state. Alaska was not a state then. It was a territory.
Oh.
It was the territory of Alaska, and it was managed by the Department of the Interior, and they were paving the Alcan Highway, or the American portion, which ended at the Canadian border and went to Fairbanks and Anchorage, and up to that time, as a matter of fact, much of the highway from the from after you left Calgary and Edmonton and headed north, there was almost another 1,000 miles through the Yukon. That was all gravel. We drove almost 1,000 miles on gravel roads that had been built really during the war to get supplies up to the Aleutians and Alaska during the war, when it was there was always the threat of Japanese invasion. But when we went there in the summer of 52, the war was over, what, 6 or 7 years, and that road was still gravel. Still gravel. Yeah.
And you were stationed then outside of Anchorage?
Yeah, in a little town called Glen Allen, named for a man, Glen Allen, I guess, A-L. Glen Allen was named for the first, I think, the first casualty during the Aleutian campaign. He was, a Canadian, an Alaskan kid who got killed. And
Aleutian campaign during the war?
During the war, there had been an attempted invasion of some of the Aleutians by the Japanese, as I recall. And I don't know the exact story, but he was an American soldier who was killed. At any rate, that little town is there because it's the crossroads when you come in from Canada. You either go north at that point to Fairbanks, or you go south west to Anchorage, or you go south to Valdez. As a matter of fact, Valdez, where they had the terrible oil spill in the Prince Edward Sound, the Exxon Valdez. But that little town was a port of not for there was no oil at the time because the Alaskan Hot Pipeline hadn't even been thought of then. But it was a port, and we used to go down there on the weekends. And it was a little town with a fishing village essentially, and it was fun, but basically we worked and slept and ate and made a good money and turned around at the end of August, I don't remember the exact date, early September, and drove all the way back, and I think we arrived back in New York a few days before school opened, and that's when my mother told me I'd gotten this letter that I was going to lose my scholarship because I got an F in German. Mm-hmm. And that was the next day, the next morning, she and I drove up, and I've told you that story. Mm-hmm. Went to Colgate, and I pleaded, and she pleaded, and turned out to be fortuitous, because as a result of that disaster for me, I studied night and day in my junior year and got all A's in all the tough pre-med courses, and I'm sure that got me into school.
That must have been an interesting experience, because I would think this might have been your first exposure to a type of person outside of your own circle, really.
It was the first time I'd been away from home.
These must have been some pretty rough and tough
guys. Oh, they were.
The college, that's right. Kids,
oh, yes. The college kids like myself, who just drove the trucks, we did what we were told, but the supervisors and the engineers and the road crews and the people that ran it, oh, they were rough and tough. And I can remember there were local bars, you know, where they'd go, and on a Saturday night, it was Hollywood movie at its best, you know. I didn't drink, so it never bothered me, but I'd get the hell out of there, because that someone would have too much to drink and start a bar brawl, and you didn't want to be caught, you know. And I think I don't even know if they had police around. I mean, whatever. It was wild and woolly, but for most of us, we were fairly protected. If you wanted to go back to the barracks and go to sleep, no one bothered you. And
But you didn't. How long did that project take? That was over a couple of years. Wasn't it?
Oh, yes, they did. Oh, the work had been going on several summers before. Mm-hmm. I think we might have been in the third or fourth summer, because when we got there, a lot of it had been done. And I think there was still several more years to go, because they basically had about three to four months of construction. Essentially, the rivers would, and the snow would melt, the rivers and the flooding would stop, and the weather would be good. And so they'd do their paving in June, I think we got there around the 10th of June. They do their paving June, July, August, and September. By September, the frost would start coming, and everybody headed the hell out who wanted to get caught there in the wintertime.
Didn't you have to drive out a long ways every morning to go to where they were working?
No, no, because where we were staying in this little town of Glen Allen, that's where the barracks were. So the trucks would come in there, that's where we'd all sleep, and that's where we'd all eat. And I can remember eating at tables. It must have been, some of those tables, I think, were 20, 30 feet long, and there must have been 40 kids, 40 young people on just devouring this food that was just being put out. And then we'd go out, put on our jackets, and take our rain gear, because it was fairly wet at times, and we'd get in our trucks or whatever, and we might, drive 15, 20 miles to wherever they were working for that day or two, and you come back home at night. So, it wasn't that long. Like any other construction, if you go out to where they left the trucks, but since they were working around the clock, it was essentially you'd come, you'd relieve Joe. Joe would go back, eat and sleep for his 12 hours, and you'd take over his truck, and they'd put in more gas and oil, and you'd take off.
As the road progressed further and further away,
that's right.
That spot, you'd move your camp, wouldn't you?
No.
You'd move a camp?
No. For that summer, we just stayed in the same thing. But yeah, we might drive 20, 30 miles to get to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the other thing we started to talk about before was the Colgate 13,
yes.
Which I found kind of interesting
yeah.
would be interesting for this book. So
yeah, it was founded, it was a men's group, a cappella, no accompaniment, essentially three quartets, because they had three bass, baritone, first and second tenor, and a leader. A 13 has a significance at Colgate because it was always said traditionally that it was founded by 13 men with 13 prayers and $13, that sort of mythical thing. So the word, the number 13 also had a lot of significance, and Colgate still does. Anyway, this group was founded by just a bunch of guys during the war, 1942. They'd sing at the local Colgate Inn, and they would start doing harmony. At that time, and just after Fred Waring and Robert Shaw and those people had very well-known choruses, so a lot of it was an imitation of that kind of singing, mostly classic show tunes, that sort of stuff. And then in the, actually the years, for first couple of years that I was there, we started moving out from singing around the local area, Albany, Syracuse, Utica, Ithaca, mostly college kind of song fest. They began to start visiting high schools as a recruiting tool. We used to sing in a lot of high school assemblies, and then one of us, usually me as the leader in my senior year, would talk about Colgate and encourage high school kids to come. We would usually go to high schools where other college kids, Colgate kids had come from. And then we started going and getting into singing in nightclubs, singing on TV, which was just getting started, radio.
What was your impression of that place?
Well, that was in my junior year, so that would have been the spring of 53, my junior year. And all I remember is we had a couple of concerts. We were singing in Palm Springs, and my only memory of that was getting in these cars that had been rented for us and going through these miles and miles and miles of orange groves and fruit groves, I guess, which are no longer there. I guess Orange County is no longer there, or whatever it was. I remember that. I don't remember much else.
That would be interesting coming from New York.
Yeah.
You think oranges are only come in a crate.
Yeah.
Think of them hanging on a tree.
No, I don't remember much more about that. Do we remember we went, they were making, I remember this, they were making The Robe at the time. Forgotten who played in that. I think it was...
Was that Kirk Douglas?
No. I think it was Richard Burton, I think one of his first movies. And I'm not sure of that. But anyway, I remember we went on that set. That was impressive to see these big Hollywood sets that we had never seen before. And then we sang at a couple of benefits. Sang with Doris Day at a benefit. Got a picture of myself with her.
So you got to meet her.
Yeah, and we sang on the Red Skelton Show, which was a TV show at the time. And most of what we did was considered good PR for the university. These were healthy, well-mannered college kids.
Clean cut.
We wore tuxes, or we wore a blazer and shirt and tie, and we stood up and we sang, and we were very good. We had won a number of intercollegiate song fests all over the Northeast.
I would like to get that. Is that the tape there?
I
got it last time.
That's the tape of at our 50th reunion. But in there, we had made, when I was a junior, I think we made an RCA Victor recording, and we've made, I think the group subsequently has made three or four.
They were getting money out of that?
A little bit, mostly to help support travel.
Because
most of the cost was travel.
We
didn't get paid a thing.
Pay?
No. Occasionally they, launder your shirts, but you really, all your travel expenses were paid if we flew or you drove or took a train. But we did a lot of mooching, too. We would, the alumni were very, very helpful. And frequently we would go, and six or seven alumni in a community who we would contact in advance would put us up in their homes, and they'd feed us and all that. So it was...
good training.
Oh, yeah.
To come.
Right. So I sang in that group as a freshman 4 years. Was elected the leader. We elected our own leader, and it was his responsibility to manage it and to conduct it and be the spokesperson. So that was a very important experience for me.
Is college still going?
Oh gosh, yeah. It's twice its size, but they admitted women at first in the mid 70s, I'm guessing. It's probably been 20 years. So in the mid 70s, women were admitted, and now I think, I follow the alumni news, I think that when I was there, there was something like 1,200 students. Now there's closer to 2,000, and it's probably, I'm not sure, but probably 40% women now.
What was Hamilton, New York like then? Was similar to Rochelle?
No. Hamilton was a little tiny college town. As a matter of fact, everything there survived on the college. The men's store, the bookstore, the theater would be packed with students on Friday and Saturday night seeing, movies. The college
industry?
No, none that I'm aware of. There was a milk processing. There was a lot of farms around it. When you go to Hamilton, coming south from Utica, when you get off the train, or coming over the what is now the New York Thruway, it wasn't there at the time, or coming up south from Binghamton on back roads, you went through miles and miles and miles of central New York, rolling hills, almost all farm, a lot of dairy farms. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I ever saw one of these big, enormous tank cars, speeding down these little tiny roads, and screech to a halt, and they'd pick up the milk. The farmer would throw his whatever how many cans of milk in, and they go on to the next place. And where they ended up, I have no idea. I think they did have a milk processing plant near there, but basically the houses were practically all occupied by faculty, and the College Inn was supported by essentially the university's visitors, alumni, and guests. The main street in town was Fraternity Row, where there were, 15 or 16 or 17 fraternities. And other than the university, there was nothing else there. Everybody who was there had something or another to do with the university, or was a service supported by the university. It was out in the middle of a beautiful rolling hills of central New York, but a small little town.
That's sort of, you could just almost describe early Reno that way. Because the college was such a big...
Yeah.
When, in the 20s and 30s,
yeah.
when this place was just a college town.
Yeah. And no, Hamilton. Hamilton was all, and as we talked earlier, Clinton, which is north of Hamilton on your way to Utica, is where Hamilton College is, and people would always get those two confused. Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, and Colgate in Hamilton, New York.
That's where Dr. Massoff.
Yes.
So I was confused.
Very similar little college town, but there were lots of others throughout that part. Whereas Ithaca, where Cornell is a pretty big city, and Syracuse, of course, a pretty big city. So
we're going to start into a medical school.
Yeah.
Now, so
one thing I did, you were right, that piece of paper I gave you about my mother's wedding date and my older sister was wrong. I looked it up. My parents were married in April of 21, as you see.
Oh, uh-huh.
And my sister was born in April of 22.
Okay.
But we can correct that when we see that.
Yeah, and we go through
okay, I just wanted to put that on the record.
Good, thanks for checking it out.
Okay.
We'll check on that then. So it was 21.
Yeah, that paper I gave you had the wrong address.
Okay.
Wrong date.
What was Albany like when you got there?
Capital
of the
state.
Capital of a large state.
Yeah, but it was a pretty old, as I recall, because remember the big development in Albany came later when Rockefeller was the governor.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I was there from 54 to 58, it was a pretty old city. It had been a Democratic, Irish Democratic political seat. For years, the same couple of politicians ran it, as I understand, for years and years and years. Oh, I didn't know much about it. I had only visited Albany once in my life, and that was to be interviewed to go to medical school. And when I went back, there was a fairly old hospital, which has all been changed, well, modern, but it was an old hospital, and a fairly small medical school building attached to the back of the hospital. You'd walk through a hallway to get into the hospital. It was literally attached, as though you'd attach something to the back of Washoe or St. Mary's. And then they had an old TB hospital across a parking lot that had been there and still had active TB patients at the time. Because you remember Saranac Lake was north of Albany, and Saranac Lake for years had been a refuge for sending people with tuberculosis, you know, used to get out into the mountains in the cool air, I guess. And then they had a little blood bank and a few other things, and it was considered an average medical school. It was part of Union University, so it had an academic base, but Union University was in Schenectady, 20 miles away.
There was a medical school up there?
No.
No?
Albany was the medical school for Union University. But it had always been connected to the hospital. And it was one of the older medical schools in the country, founded back in the 1850s or 60s. And it, like many medical schools we talked about earlier, was attached to a hospital. But it survived after the Flexner and got itself attached to Union University. Many other hospital-based medical schools and clinic-based medical schools and doctor office-based medical schools disappeared from the scene after the Flexner report.
Mm-hmm.
And I can look up the date, it will, before we edit this. I think it's 1915 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So Albany was one of those schools, like a Flower and Fifth Avenue in New York, that survived the Flexner Report, made the change to an academic university base with science, and survived that. But it always had the tradition of being part of the Albany Medical Center, if you will. Yes, we had a chancellor over in Schenectady, and the dean did report to him, but it was pretty much independent. And it was
a
lot of symbiotic relationship between the hospital and the medical school.
Who was the dean? Do you remember?
Yes, very well. When
who
I got
was the man you
yeah,
told me about.
When I got there, his name was Wiggers, Dean Wiggers, and he was a PhD, which was unusual. Many deans, or most deans, have been, certainly more recently and for a long period of time, were physicians. But Dean Wiggers was a PhD physiologist. His father was a famous physiologist, well known in the physiology world, Cleveland, I believe, at Western Reserve. And Western Reserve University, the senior Wiggers had been a world famous cardiac physiologist. Well, anyway, the son had just been appointed the dean at Albany when I got there. He was very good with students.
He was not an MD?
No, he wasn't. No, he was a PhD in physiology. And he was, I think, very forward-thinking and brought in some very good faculty. But it was still considered a fairly small school. Did not have anywhere near the research base, either money or faculty or reputation, that the schools in New York City had, like Cornell or Columbia, or certainly nothing like the New England schools that, at Harvard and Boston and Yale and those places. But it had been for years a school that essentially produced a lot of family physicians. They were called GPs in those days, for upstate New York. And many of the alumni, it's changed, but in those days, many of the alumni had settled all around Albany, Schenectady, Troy, up to Saranac Lake, Lake Champlain, west toward Utica. Lots of Albany graduates went into general practice. And of course, when I got to medical school in 1954, still a significant percentage of medical school graduates were going into general practice, one-year internship still. Family practice, as especially, hadn't gotten started. That was 15 years later. The board of family medicine, I think, got started in 1969. So this is 54, 15 years earlier. There were still GPs who got 1 year of internship, maybe did some military service, although the Korean War was now over, and Vietnam hadn't even begun. So they would go into practice. Several of my classmates went into practice after a 1 year internship.